this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here, not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to tonight. It's one of my views, and for the next half hour, they're going to be those of Stephen Mosier, who's the president of the Population Research Institute, and an organization that is really working very, very hard to educate the American people about the issue of population. And, of course, they are strongly pro-life. They believe that the population bomb, the population explosion that we're being told about, just isn't true. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us once again.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Dr. Stan.
Why don't you just perhaps address the issue? Though we're told about, oh, my goodness, you know, the population of the world is exploding. Oh, we've just got to do something. We're going to be standing on one another's shoulders before long. We're going to have hundreds of billions of people or tens of billions of people all throughout the world. And we're just running out of space and food and water. And what is the reality of this issue?
Well, the reality is that birth rates are falling faster and farther than anyone 50 years ago imagined possible. People thought 50 years ago that families in, say, India, or families in China, families in Africa, would keep having large families until they reached Western living standards, until all those countries developed to the point of, say, Europe or the United States. And, of course, that's not what happened. What happened was that as soon as modern medicine came on the scene and birth rates and death rates, rather, started to fall, and as soon as the population controllers came on the scene and began sterilizing and contracepting and aborting large numbers of women, the birth rate just plummeted. And now worldwide we see couples averaging only about 2.7 children. I say 2.7, only 2.7, because in 1960 they were averaging twice that. And 2.7 is not all that far from what we call replacement rate fertility, which is the number of children born to the average woman necessary to maintain the current population. And, you know, in the United States that's 2.1, where you have high infant mortality, that is 2.2 or 2.3. So averaging 2.7 children worldwide, we're not more than a half a child above replacement rate fertility. So the whole business of a population bomb, an uncontrolled explosion of people, breeding ourselves off the face of the planet, human beings expanding to tens of billions of people, it's just a fairy tale. It's just a myth. It's still being propagated by people who have a vested interest in, of course, making money off this myth. Most of the money, of course, being tax dollars paid into the federal treasury by you and I. But the reality is that population is going to peak in a very few decades, around 2040, we now estimate. It's going to peak around 8 billion people. We've got 6.3 billion alive now. And then, once it peaks, it will begin to decline, slowly at first, but then faster and faster and faster, assuming nothing is done to turn it around. And so our long-term problem, the global problem, is not a population explosion at all. It's a population implosion. And Europe, of course, is already imploding at an ever-increasing rate. Hello?
Yes, one of the points you make so well is the fact that in many countries, why, of course, there are far more people in caskets than there are in cradles. In other words, one of the problems is that a lot of the older people are living longer. That's why the population is really increasing. It's people are not dying off as fast as they used to, but you know, I think when you get into what's really going on in Europe, here we see actually falling population rates, don't we?
Well, we do. Something very strange and unprecedented in European history.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Go right ahead.
something strange in European history began to happen around 2000, just a few years ago. The population of Europe began to decline. And it's declining now, has been declining now for the better part of a decade. And it's declining despite fairly large numbers of immigrants coming from the Middle East, coming from North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. And it's declining because a few decades ago, the Italians and the Spaniards and the Germans and the French and the other European peoples saw their birth rates drop well below replacement, well below two children. Currently, you've got couples in Italy, couples in Spain, averaging only slightly more than one child. That's a recipe for absolute, not just decline, but an absolute demographic disaster. What happens to a country like Italy when its population of 66 million is cut in half to 33 million by low birth rate? The factories empty out, the cities empty out, the country is no longer capable of defending itself. There are no longer enough taxpayers to fund the generous welfare programs and retirement programs. One can see that kind of demographic collapse would lead to a total societal and economic collapse as well. It would be, as we say, the death of what's left of Western civilization.
Well, I think it's so vitally important that people understand that it's a factor in Russia, too. It's a factor in Japan. In all of these countries, people are not having enough children to replace the population. What's happening in Japan? There you have real problems there, don't they?
Well, they do. In the early 1950s, Japan legalized abortion. And abortion is still today the primary means that people use to control their families. So the average Japanese woman has two or three abortions or more in the course of her lifetime. And the birth rate dropped below replacement in 1964, very early, 44 years ago now. And it's continued dropping since. It's now, I think, at 1.33 children. But it has fallen so far and so fast that the Japanese population, the population of the home islands of Japan, is now shrinking and aging more rapidly than most human populations are aging on the planet. It's no accident that Japan has more than half of all the industrial robots in the world working in Japanese factories because there are no longer enough young Japanese to fill those jobs or trying to fill them with robots.
Hold that thought for just a moment as we bring our stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Stephen Mosier was simply saying that in Europe, if you go into Spain and Italy, why, the fertility rate is about 1.1 child per family, which means, of course, that what you're going to do, have a nation like Italy with 66 million people, what's going to happen, you know, a generation from now, there's only going to be about 30 million people there. And then after two generations, why, of course, only 15 million people, these countries are simply destroying themselves. Stephen was talking about the tragedy that's unfolding in Japan, which, of course, you never hear about, where, of course, they don't really have enough young people working in the factories now, and, of course, the older people are aging, and the younger people, well, there just really aren't that many of them. Go right ahead and pick up the story there, please.
Well, Japan went into a recession in the 1990s after having had a couple decades of explosive economic growth. And I think that what happened to Japan was it was experiencing what we might call the world's first demographic recession. It was a recession brought on by the fact that so many people were retiring and so few young people were coming into the workforce that they were paying a price, a heavy price, for having such a high abortion rate, such a low birth rate. The tragedy of Japan is expressed in other ways as well. Elderly Japanese, having maybe one child and no grandchildren, are actually renting young couples with children so that they can pretend for a day or for a weekend that they are really the grandparents of these grandchildren. It's all just make-believe, of course, and it shows the ache in the human heart from not having the children that they should have had, you know, 30 or 40 years before. They're also making little robots. I mentioned the robots in the factories busy producing goods. but they're also making little robots to look like little grandchildren and programming the robots with several thousand stock phrases that that children might use to ask their grandparents questions. Like, the robot will say something like, "Grandpa, why do birds fly?" And on and on, "Why is the sky blue?" And it's a sad thing to think that these elderly Japanese, and the Japanese live longer than any other people in the world because of their diet of fish and rice, these elderly Japanese are tricking themselves into thinking that they really have a child when all they have is a piece of plastic and metal and a circuit board.
Well, the human tragedy as a result of population control is really immeasurable. Let's talk a little bit about the one-child policy in China, because, of course, this was largely a Western idea, wasn't it? Really, didn't this come out of the ideas of the Club of Rome, and then initially helped and coordinated by the International Planned Parenthood with, of course, American tax money?
Well, absolutely, Dr. Stan. It was a Western export to China, an export from the radical environmentalists, the radical population controllers at this group called the Club of Rome. They commissioned a study that was published in 1974 that predicted worldwide disaster in a century if countries didn't start controlling their population. It predicted that we would run out of petroleum in 1988, of iron ore in 1993, of zinc and chromium and other mineral reserves shortly thereafter. And it was a fraud. It was a fraud because they assumed no new discoveries of petroleum, no new discoveries of other resources. And they admitted later, 2 years later, that they had deliberately exaggerated the numbers and made unreasonable assumptions because they wanted to convince the European Parliament, they wanted to convince the British Parliament, they wanted to convince the American Congress that population growth was leading to a disaster and that these various representative bodies should spend huge sums of money to solve the problem. Well, they succeeded in that. I mean, the U.S. Congress was, by the early 70s, appropriating hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars for the purpose of driving down fertility rates. So were most European countries. But about that time, in 1976, a Chinese systems engineer by the name of Song Zhen came across the Club of Rome report. He didn't know it was a fraud. He thought it was reality. He took it back to China, translated it into Chinese, applied it to the Chinese situation, making the same false assumptions, concluded that China could support no more than 600 million people. And so China's population, he thought, was far too large for the country's resources. He took the study to the senior leadership, then headed by Deng Xiaoping, and he convinced the senior leadership that this was the very best in Western science. Well, it wasn't. It was the very best in radical environmentalist propaganda. But nevertheless, that was the basis for the one-child policy. And the Club of Rome may have just been trying to deceive the world's peoples and parliaments into funding population control programs, but Chinese women and children have been dying in earnest ever since.
And one of the points you make is that they, at least early in the program, they were actually going right along with killing little girl children. If a child was born, it was a girl, they simply killed it so they could have another child, and that would be a boy. Is that right?
Well, that's still going on today. I mean, I was the first American scholar allowed to do research in China back in 1979. And I got there just about the same time that the International Planned Parenthood Federation got there, the same time the UN Population Fund got there. It took me a few months to discover that the one-child policy was being carried out by horrific, barbaric means, including arresting women for the crime of being pregnant, detaining them for weeks or months at a time, and at the end of the day, aborting them. The UN Population Fund was very enthusiastic about the idea of China controlling its population, as was the International Planned Parenthood Federation. Neither of them had any qualms about abortion. They may, from time to time, say they're not in favor of forced abortion, but they have been funding China's program from the very beginning, and they know what it involves. So these organizations have provided a lot of cover to Beijing, because when the Chinese people complain about the one-child policy, the Beijing government can say, well, look, these prestigious international organizations, the United Nations supports us. The International Planned Parenthood Federation supports our one-child policy. Who are you, the Chinese people, to criticize it?
You know, I think what's really so disturbing is, of course, that the United States is one of the major sources of the funding that has been used for coercive population control, not only in China, but all throughout the world, in South America and Africa. Could you describe how they force women to be aborted, how they force them to use certainly contraceptives and other techniques that are used in third world countries that would never be allowed in the United States?
Well, you know, we're talking about China, but of course it's not just China. We have documented human rights abuses in population control programs, I think in 42, 43 countries. I have a chart that goes on for a couple pages in my new book, Population Control, detailing the countries and the types of abuses that you find in those countries. And some of the countries do go as far as China. Vietnam, for example, has a two-child policy and concentrates on sterilizing women after their second child. The sterilization campaign has been particularly active in the minority areas. We have Hmong living in this country. Many of them reside in California. The Hmong were Laotian Hills Treaty people who fought on the side of South Vietnam, on the side of the United States in the Vietnam War. And perhaps for this reason, the Vietnamese, Communist Vietnamese government has targeted Hmong villages for almost 100% compulsory sterilization. The mobile sterilization team will go into a Hmong village and will sterilize all girls past puberty, married or not, whether or not they have children or not. So those are the kinds of abuses you find in Vietnam. North Korea has a policy of limiting people to two children, as does South Korea, for that matter, at our insistence. In South Korea, the program is not nearly as draconian, but it does involve denial of educational benefits and health care benefits to couples who violate the two-child policy. The policy has just a few years ago been stopped, but for years and years it denied these kinds of benefits. Government officials, anyone employed by the government, could not have a third child. They would lose their position if they violated the two-child policy.
And wasn't this really in large part due to the pressure put on by the United States to force them to limit their population growth?
Well, of course it was. The countries of Taiwan and Thailand and South Korea were virtually American protectorates in the 1950s and 60s. And because they were so dependent on the United States for the national security, they had to go along with the program. They were used as guinea pigs. The entire countries were used as experimental models for population control. So the programs in Korea and Taiwan and Thailand began in the early 1960s, and they involved the massive distribution of IUDs, the hiring of many, many representatives to go around the countryside urging women to adopt this so-called modern means of contraception. It involved a massive distribution of abortifacient contraceptives and the encouragement of sterilization after the women had two children. And this was since the United States was telling Taiwan and South Korea and Thailand to do these things, the governments went along with the program. I think they have all come to regret this policy now. Taiwan has abandoned this policy. It abandoned this policy in the 1990s and now has a birth rate only slightly above one child and a labor shortage. South Korea abandoned the policy in the mid-1990s and is now encouraging South Koreans to have second and third children. Thailand has a birth rate that's below replacement. I think the latest figures are 1.7 children, and the villages in Thailand are empty of children and young people. The young people who were never born, or the few who were born, went to the cities, so the villages are filled with the elderly. So these are the sad consequences of adopting a policy, not of welcoming life, but of encouraging death.
And, you know, I think it's really so amazing that the average American has no idea how their tax money has been used for years for coercive population control. They call it family planning, of course. But, of course, when you threaten many of these women, you coerce them into being sterilized. Why, it's the same thing. We'll be right back. Well, certainly as we look and see what's happening in other countries throughout the world, and of course, I think, what about the United States? What's happening here as far as our population is concerned? Are we increasing our population because of fertility or because of immigration?
Well, the United States is unique among all the developed countries of the world. We're unique because every other developed country, Dr. Stan, is dying. It has a birth rate that is below replacement. Without exception, the United States is the only country that has a birth rate that is developed, that has a birth rate that is at replacement. For years, we were below replacement. Roe versus Wade ensured that the total fertility rate dropped from over about 2.5 children down to about 1.5 children at its low point. But it gradually climbed back up. America has become gradually more pro-life over the last few decades. And just this year, in fact, not too long ago, it was announced that we were back at 2.1. And this was 2.1 children per woman for all racial groups. Native Americans, white Americans, black Americans, Hispanic Americans were all, native-born Hispanic Americans were all at about 2.1. Now, it's hard to know what the birth rate is of immigrants in this country, because so many immigrants are illegal immigrants. And on the one hand, you have a large concentration of single men among the illegal immigrants who have no children. But on the other hand, you do have illegal immigrants, women, coming across the border as well, and they may have three children. But it seems to me that immigration as a whole is not a huge factor here. We are replacing ourselves, and our population, because of immigration, is growing.
All right, fine. Well, now, right now, of course, we have a population of a little over 300 million, but we've certainly gone from about, well, I can remember when we were 150 million, and now we're 300 million. Has most of that been due to fertility or immigration from other countries? That would be the thing that I'm speaking of.
Well, much of that has come about because of births to people already in the United States. I think the figures would be if we had had no immigration from 1972 on. In 1972, we had 170 million people. If we had no immigration from 1970 on, we would probably have about 240 million people today instead of the 300 million that we have. So we've had substantial numbers of immigrants, and they in turn, like all immigrants throughout American history, have had children of their own. I am, of course, a big advocate of increasing the birth rate among Americans. And I think if we were to shelter young couples from taxes, if we were to encourage marriage and strengthen families, we could easily get the birth rate in this country up to 2.5 children or even closer to 3. During the 1950s, the baby boom of the 1950s, Americans were averaging 4 children. If we were averaging just 2.5, we would keep Social Security solvent for an extra 20 years. If we were averaging 3 children, Social Security would be solvent forever. The system would work at its current retirement age, at current benefit levels, forever.
And I think it's really so important for people to realize the complications as far as our social programs are from the lack of children. We'll be right back here in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, one of the problems that occurs in developed nations when you have these population control programs and women just stop having children is that they're not the young people then to be working to take care of the older people when they retire. And of course, we're having more and more older people retire here in the United States. Right now, it's estimated we have about 1.6 people working for every person retired. But what happens when we get down down to one person working for every one person retired, and we promised those retired people certainly free health care. We promised them Social Security. Where's the money going to come from, though, if there's only one person working for every person retired?
Oh, the worker dependency ratio is getting worse and worse, and Europe's problem, of course, is that they're a lot further down this particular path than we are. And they've had to keep tax rates high, raise them even higher for this very reason. And when you take more than half of the income of a young person away from him or her on the grounds that the state needs that money to provide its, to fund its cradle-to-grave welfare system, to fund its technically bankrupt pension fund, and you leave young people with so little disposable income, what do they do? What can they do? Young Italians, young Spaniards, even young Germans feel unable to marry because they can't afford to buy a house. Or if they do save and save for years and get married, they feel unable to afford to have children because the state has left so little income to them. And that just perpetuates, not only perpetuates the problem, but it makes it worse. This is a, not just a vicious circle, this is a descending spiral where each generation is parasitical on the succeeding generation and on its children. And the succeeding generations get smaller and smaller and smaller, and the problem gets worse and worse over time. I quite frankly think that the cradle-to-grave welfare system of the socialist countries of Europe is a kind of collective suicide pact. I've said this before. I think that with high tax rates, with tax rates that are punitive and leave young people without the wherewithal to marry and have children, they are in effect eating their seed corn. They're driving down the birth rate to such low levels that extinction is almost a foregone conclusion.
In fact, one of the things you point out in your book is the fact that, in France today, they're actually paying women to have children. They're encouraging and doing everything desperately, trying to get women to have children. But we're not hearing about that in this country.
Well, I mean, they're not every European country, without exception, because I've looked from one end of Europe to the other, from Sweden in the north to Italy in the south, from Ireland in the west to European Russia in the east. They all have a whole host of incentives in place to encourage young people to have children. Russia pays a young couple $9,000 for every baby born. Sweden gives the husband or the wife a year of paid leave for every baby born and a guarantee that they can return to their job at the end of it. But all of these things count for nothing, apparently, in the eyes of the peoples on whom they're bestowed, because the birth rates are still below replacement. Because the fundamental problem is that the government takes so much away from working people in these countries that even if it gives a fraction of it back, the people still feel themselves to be unable to afford to have children. And so the whole system is based on the faulty idea that the government can award enough benefits to encourage people to have children. The government itself is the biggest antinatal factor in Europe. It's the biggest force against robust fertility. And the government itself has to get out of the way. I don't know that it will in Europe, but it has to a certain extent in the United States, where we have a large now deduction for each dependent, almost $5,000, and we have a tax credit, a direct credit against taxes of $1,000 for each child. And that combination of deduction and tax credit means that the average young couple of modest income with two or three children pays no income tax in the United States.
And of course, that's one reason why we are doing better than the other countries in the world. Before we have to let you go, would you want to get out your telephone number of the Population Research Institute and tell people where they can get your book?
Well, they can get it at bookstores everywhere, but they can also go to our website at on the World Wide Web at pop.org. That's pop.org, pop short for Population Research Institute. And of course, they could call us, Dr. Stan, as well, if they'd like to, at 540-622 5240.
One more time, please.
The number is 540-622-5240. And we have what we call free population packets for anyone who's interested in delving deeper into these questions.
God bless you. Thanks very much, Stephen. Bye-bye. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and my guest this evening is Stephen Mosier, and he's been very gracious to be on our other programs. This evening it's 11 o'clock back in the East where he lives, so he could only be with us for half an hour. But if you'd like one of those other programs, we do have them available. Stephen certainly is one of the most informative people on this subject of population control, which you know is very, very close to my heart. But he is probably the world's leading expert on this subject, and his book on population control, we will be carrying it. If you'd like to get it, you can call us at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, pardon me, I should say 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-544-8927. Of course, you can get it from the Population Research Institute. They'll have autographed copies. We won't be able to have those, but it's an excellent book. It is a book that's needed to be written for a long time. I wish I'd written it myself, but Stephen has done a much better job than I would have been able to have done. So if you'd like to get the book, telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. The average American does not understand that the United States government is putting out about $400 million a year for coercive population control throughout the rest of the world. And it is little wonder that other countries hate us. The women who are deprived of their ability to have children, the men in India who are rounded up at bayonet point and forcibly sterilized, their deference actually tied off. And of course that led to the toppling of the regime of Indira Gandhi, who was simply carrying out American foreign policy. The major force behind this whole coercive population control agenda is tragically our country and the American taxpayers, and yet the average American has no idea what's really going on, and they don't discuss this here in the United States. Why is it that we are pushing these programs? Well, of course, you need to read the National Security Study Memorandum 200. That's the National Security Study Memorandum 200. It came out in 1974. It was authorized by President Richard Nixon, and that was reason enough to have him impeached and actually executed, in my estimation. But, of course, it came out under the name of Henry Kissinger, and it pointed out that if other countries were to have large populations, they might industrialize, they might compete with us. The way we would keep other countries impoverished throughout the world was population control. But we could not tell the public that. We could not tell the other countries that. So we had to pretend that what we were doing had to do with our concern over the poor and suffering in underdeveloped countries. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Stephen Mosier of the Population Research Institute, and certainly an outstanding researcher on this field, and we're indebted to him for writing his book. If you'd like to get a copy of his book, Population Control, it's just actually been out a few weeks. Why, you can get it by calling 1-800-544-8927. Actually, we have two interviews with Stephen at the present time. We actually have them available. They're an hour-long interviews. Excellent source of information. We'll, of course, be featuring them on our Saturday program. If you'd like to listen to the programs, they're archived at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And we'll be archiving the Saturday program in a couple of weeks. If you want to hear it, it's only 30 minutes, but it's amazing how much information we can cover with Stephen in a short period of time, because he has this very well organized in his own mind. And remember, he was the first scholar, American scholar in China, ever allowed to go into the hinterlands, and this was about 1979 or 1980. And he was there when they actually introduced the one-child policy, where they were killing girl children. And when he came back and told about how the Chinese government was allowing the murder, the genocide of girl children, female children, because, of course, the parents could only have one child, They wanted a boy who would look after them in their old age and continue the legacy. Why, of course, Stephen was fired by Stanford University and blacklisted, so he couldn't get a job anywhere in the country, because, you see, the American people are never supposed to understand that the United States and the wicked people who control our government are the primary force behind coercive population control throughout the world and robbing women of their heritage. And that is the ability to have children. Well, our telephone number, we're going to be doing open lines, so our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And I remember, because these global population control programs are still going on throughout the world, the American people don't talk about it, and really, unless you really understand that AIDS is simply a means of population control. Yes, acquired immunodeficiency disease. We, to this very date, are not using any of the effective or well-recognized public health procedures needed to stop the spread of this plague in Africa, even here in the United States. Although we do have mandatory reportability in some states, most states do not have it. Why is mandatory reportability important? So you can identify who has the disease and gave it to the target patient, and who that patient may have given it to. But we're not trying to stop the disease, and over half a million Americans have died. We do not have mandatory prenatal testing in most of our states. We do not have mandatory neonatal testing, in other words, the testing of children, because, of course, those children could be placed on medication and, in many instances, prevented from getting the disease. We're not doing that. We're not trying to stop this disease. They have killed over half a million Americans, and where is the outcry? I mean, certainly, I fought this battle with an organized medicine for a decade, trying, of course, to get them to introduce the standard and effective public health measures. And now, almost 30 years, well, the first cases were described in 1981, and it's now 27 years later, why a few of those mandatory public health techniques, which is used for every other disease, have been now introduced here and for the trying to stop the spread of the disease. But the our public health officials have betrayed the American public. The Centers for Disease Control betrayed the American public. And if you haven't read my book, it is still the best book on the politics of AIDS. It's called AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, and it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. The AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, and we put out probably, maybe pretty close to 25, 26,000 copies across America when it came out, and it is still the best book available on the politics of AIDS. And we might just point out that in Botswana today, they are monitoring the course of this terrible, deadly disease in the general population there. It is being done by your U.S. Commerce Department. We get their information regularly. In Botswana, 46% of the pregnant women are HIV infected, and they're all going to die. That is either certainly the greatest public health failure of all time, or the most successful population control agenda of all time, and population control program of all time, and I believe that's exactly what it is, because if it was a public health failure, they would then try to remedy the situation and introduce effective public health measures, and every time the Botswana people suggest that, they're threatened with withdrawal of foreign aid if they dare to try to stop the epidemic. A great human tragedy. Well, right now, let's go to Lynn, who's calling us from Indiana. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. Hi, Lynn. How are you doing?
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing just great.
Great. I just want to make a comment on your last speaker, that he's definitely telling the truth. And it's just amazing how our government lies to young women. I'm one of the people that bought the lie. I'll buy the lie. I thought by getting a college education, I would get a decent paying job and able to pay my bills and able to afford a house and a family. And I've got bachelor's degrees and a master's degree, and all I got with it, I have a job I love, but I'm in debt to a student loan. And I was able to afford children. I'm in my 40s now because I couldn't pay for the daycare. because I'm public assistance. And the women that aren't married, you know, the ones that are poor and uneducated, they can get assistance. And a lot of working professional women, a lot of them, I know 9 or 10 that wanted a family and just didn't have the money to have one. And that's not fair.
I know it isn't fair. But this whole thing isn't fair. We are actively destroying the fertility of the people in the third world countries, and we're doing everything they can to, of course, to lower the living standards here in America and make it increasingly difficult. And things may be difficult now, but they're going to get so much worse. There is a program ready to lower the living standards here in America. It is being put into place right today, and of course, all you have to do is read the Earth Charter, and it's available up on the Internet, where they talk about how they're going to have equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations, and that means they're going to send our wealth to underdeveloped countries. There's not one American in 1,000 who really understands that what's happening today is not by accident. It has nothing to do with the rising price of oil. That's being intensely raised, the rise of food, all of these things are being raised. The inflation is going to be used to lower our living standards so that very, very few people will be able to have children here.
Yeah, it's just not fair because it seems like once you get a college degree and you get your professional job, then the government, you know, they make laws where you have to keep going back to college.
Right.
And I can't even afford a car payment. I'm driving a car that has 400,000 miles on it. I drove a car better in high school than I do as a master's degree professional. I can't afford a car. I can never afford my own home because my student loan debt right now is $500 a month. It eventually goes up to $1,000 a month payment, you know. They want me to keep going back to college. It used to be every 8 years for certification, now it's every 4. And I just don't have, you know, $10,000 to give these universities every 4 years.
Well,
and I'm barely making my rent payments, you know, while everybody, you know, I'm just very frustrated with what this government is doing to people that want to work hard and do right and follow God's rules for being punished.
Well, I tell you, Lynn, the best thing you can do is try to get people to listen to our program. When enough people understand who really is running things and what their objectives are and what their plans are for us, maybe, just maybe, the American people will rise up in righteous indignation and demand we have fair voting and we get responsible people in Congress. Right now, they're rigging the elections. These electronic voting machines are designed so that they can be programmed, so they can steal elections and ensure that they can have the best politicians in Washington, D.C., that money could buy. Hey, thanks very much for calling, Lynn. You have my sympathy. I know the problems that you face and so many Americans face this. We need to take our country back. If we had a free society, you wouldn't have the problems you have with your training and obviously your ability.
Right. We need to stay in prayer, you know, about this to the good Lord, that he'll give people the heart to make changes.
Amen.
For those that are righteous and want to work hard. And you know, when we go to work, we work for the Lord.
Amen.
We work for him. He's our top priority. So we need to continue to give it to him and let others know about the situation. But hopefully the laws can maybe be changed in the future. I don't know what this New World Order thing going down, but all we can do is stay in prayer. That's most important.
I'm into that. Thanks very much for calling, Lynn. And let's go to Kurt from Santa Cruz. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 in the Central Coast. And hi, Kurt. How are you doing?
Fine. You know, you had this wonderful guest on the other night. By the way, the things on Gnosticism and the Babylonian mystery religions, I'd love to see more shows like that.
Well, of course, we try to have something.
One son into government and one into banking, they would put one son into the church, into the Catholic Church, and one son into banking. Now, he was talking about the Roman banking houses and how they were carried forward as they melded into the Catholic Church. Now, your guest raised some provocative questions. One was, do the Roman banking houses go back to Babylon? And I think he was saying they do and that that's well documented. But the other question is, you know, we've got the Swiss banks. Did they come from the Templars? Did they come from the Roman Catholic banking houses?
I think they probably came from the Templars, but remember the Templars were tied into the church, although the church, of course, turned against the Templars there, went along with the French king and outlawing the Templars in 1307. But be that as it may, certainly that the Swiss banking, in my way of thinking, came out of the Templars, the Knights Templars, and they are still, of course, probably the most reliable banks in the world today.
Now, but also he mentioned that the Roman banks had gone underground inside the Catholic Church. Do you know anything about that?
I really can't comment on that. I don't know about it, Kurt.
Okay, another question, and I'm hoping somebody else will have some research and call in, or some other guests that you'll have. Now, another question came up is the Bauers. Okay, they controlled the central banks in what's now Germany, England, France, Austria-Hungary, and Italy. And the Rothschild name comes from the Red Shield and the Bauer's pawn shop. But how does a pawn shop get to control five central banking houses? Now, one argument has been that Weishaupt, or Weishaupt, whichever it is, had done that with the Illuminati, but that's a lot of money.
Kurt, I think you have to understand, of course, that the Rothschilds are deeply involved with the occult. They have amassed a great fortune because of their loyalty to the dark side. And until we recognize that, and this would hold true with the Rockefellers here in the United States, I mean, who do you think controls Chase Manhattan and Citibank, two of the largest banks in the United States? They're both deeply involved with the Rockefellers, just exactly as Chevron Oil and Exxon, the two largest oil companies in the United States, are tied into the Rockefellers. But the Rockefellers are tied into the occult. And until you understand, of course, that the people from the dark side have their people planted in corporations, in industry, but specifically in finance. And this is covered in a little pamphlet that we offer today. It was actually a document that was channeled to a woman named Alice Bailey during the first half of the last century. It was channeled by a demonic spirit named Joao Cool. And we offer this today. If you'd like a free copy, give us a call. It's called The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy, where they will tell you, this is what I say, this is what they say. They are people really planted within finance throughout the world today. So this is what we're up against. Anything else, Kurt? We've got another caller.
Yes, I've got two more questions.
Well, I'll give you one. Go ahead.
Well, they're all connected. The Rogenfelders and Bowers, you know, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, in getting their money, you know, where did they get it? And the Bank of England, as you mentioned, from Henry VIII in 1694 and 96, that's before the Bower family came along. Did they just collect the English money under their name? What happened for the source on the Rogenfelders and the Bowers?
Well, you're going to have to go into the background of this. Of course, the first central bank, or the first major central bank, was the Bank of England, and that was formed in 1894 by a man named William Paterson. And the Bank of England, of course, then was able to create money out of nothing and actually finance the wars that the British were involved in, the British fleet that one day ruled the waves throughout the world. In fact, it was said that the sun never set on the British Empire, and then, of course, they funded the Napoleonic Wars, and they were able to defeat Napoleon because they were able to raise money created out of nothing to finance their wars. But, of course, at one point, while the Rockefellers challenged the Bank of England and actually broke the Bank of England and forced them under their control, and they've already been in control of the Bank of England in large part for probably 100 to 150 years. So
wasn't that Rothschild that did that?
No, it was Rothschild that did that.
Yeah.
Okay, Kurt, we're going to have to let you go. We got one more caller.
Okay, thank you.
God bless, and right now let's go to Michael in Fort Worth, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you have a question, a comment, something you'd like to talk about. Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
How are you, Dr. King?
Doing just great.
Sure was my good fortune to be able to find you on my little shortwave radio tonight. I've had bad luck with shortwave, being able to get your stations. I've been able to get some of your programming on the Internet, the afternoon program. But tonight I was just blessed. The stars were, waves were clear, and I was able to pick you up, and I'm away from my computer. So
basically, of course, we have two great stations here in the evening. We have, of course, 5.875 and 6.110. That's 5.875 and 6.110 shortwave this evening. From the first hour, which we had at both hours, but it should be pretty good. Those are the biggest shortwave broadcasters in the nation. They're 250,000 watts, both of them.
Well, that's good news. I know you've had, at least it seems to me, you've had trouble with your shortwave frequencies because they would change on me and I couldn't find you for a long time.
You can always find us up on the Internet. We'll always have the latest ones posted there. And I apologize, but that's the way shortwave is. They don't tell me in the last minute and then suddenly they announce that they're going to change tomorrow or they changed yesterday.
I followed you through several of those changes. And I miss you when I can't get you, and I feel very good tonight because I got you back on the clear shortwave connection. But my pet interest is my family. I was just got my family started good, going good. I was 50 years as an Irish Catholic that believed and practiced everything that was suggested, married an Irish Catholic girl, and along came feminism, I feel, because her attitude toward marriage and toward...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment, Michael.
Okay,
go ahead, Michael.
I
tell you what, feminism destroyed an awful lot of marriages.
Well, I find, and of course, I find now that you had a nice program on that O'Connor... A lady who was another good Irish name who had some reaction or withdrawal of feminism, but it seems to be so ingrained. What I'm finding now, I had to leave the Catholic Church because essentially they, from the local priest to the Pope, had more support for feminism and the feminism ideas and none for the husband's role as the head of the family, which is the scriptural model for a family.
Well, unfortunately, Michael, I think the Catholic Church has been infiltrated by the same forces that have infiltrated the Protestant Church and all of our denominations. And, of course, we really have to, of course, look to the Bible for our source of truth. And there it tells that the male is to be the head of the family and the wife is to be subservient. But along with that, of course, the male is the man is to be subservient to God. And, of course, he has no authority other than the authority that comes from God. And if he's not true to God, then he's not fit to lead the family.
Well, I can't argue with that position. But what I'm finding now, I've searched and searched and searched, and I can't find one denomination or one preacher in any denomination, and I'm talking about the Russian Orthodox Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, the Coptic Orthodox Church, the Roman Catholic Church, and all of the Protestant ones that are speaking out will stand up and teach the scriptural model for the organization of the family, which is unquestionably the husband is the head and has the last say in everything with respect to the family.
But remember, he's got to be subservient to our Lord Jesus Christ. So I agree with you. We have a real problem because, of course, they've infiltrated our seminaries. They've changed the message of our church. They've changed the music of our churches. But fortunately, we still have the Holy Scriptures, and that has to be the foundation of what we believe.
You're so right there. It is a little bit good to have at least someone that you can talk about what the scriptures actually say, because I find that when I'm in a discussion with any type of a theologian in a Christian church, they will not take they will not stand up and even support the scriptural order for the family.
Well, we're out of time. Michael, God bless. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ken. Keep up the good.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got just one person more. We've got Lee calling from Michigan. Lee, do you have a quick question? Because we're out of time. Lee, do you have a quick question?
Yes, my question is, if you're aware that there's 2 billion gallon barrels per day shortage in oil, and that we cannot catch up because it would take 5 to 15 years to build a refinery, the refineries around the world. So there doesn't look like any answer in sight. Do you know anything about that?
Well, first of all, of course, there's no shortage of oil at the present time. They're producing enough. But, of course, they want this problem. This is a created problem. And if you haven't yet read my newsletters, they're September and October 2005. Go to RadioLiberty.com and pull them down, or certainly you need to listen to the 4 tapes that we have on the oil deception, and of course we have a great new DVD by Lindsay Williams entitled The Energy Non-Crisis. There is no crisis here. It's all created, but of course that doesn't going to do you or me any good when we go to the gas stations, because we're going to be paying $5 a gallon for oil, $7.50, $10 a gallon. Heaven help us. Okay, but even if there were, all this oil is out there, which I believe it is, there's no way we're going to be able to get it for years. They have blocked any effort to do the development of the oil field. So we're in for a difficult time, and this could well lead to the collapse of our economy. Thanks for calling, Dee.
Thank you.
And right now, of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listeners-supported. And if you agree with me that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, economic, financial battlefield, we do hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And our telephone number is 1-888-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And if you are really not in a position to join the Radio Liberty family, then certainly encourage others to listen to our programs and learn about what's going on in the world, because you can reach an awful lot of people. Just talk to them. Get them to start tuning into Radio Liberty. Tell them about this crazy guy that's got all these crazy ideas. And they'll start out thinking we're quite insane, and before long, they'll be afraid we're not. Under any circumstances, it's up to you to get people to understand what's going on. Now, they go to our website, RadioLiberty.com. We have a section of videos they can watch for nothing, DVDs. We have a section on other videos, which I recommend to you. They can listen to our live programs 4 hours a day, our recorded programs 9 hours a day, and then, of course, our archived and MP3 programs. They can read our newsletters and get the information they need to understand what's really going on and who's really behind this. If you want to know more about population, we have a 4-tape set on population control. We have certainly my book on AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic. We have a DVD entitled None Dare Call It Genocide. And another DVD called Planned Population Reduction. That's the None Dare Call It Genocide and Planned Population Reduction. We will be carrying Stuart Mosier's book, or Stephen Mosier's book, Population Control. We think he's done a wonderful job on that, and we recommend that very, very highly. That's Population Control by Stephen Mosier, and you call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, if you'd like to get my talk on None Dare Call It Genocide, if you'd like to get my talk on planned population reduction, you can order it. And then, of course, we've written something called the Population Control Agenda Monograph. It's a Population Control Agenda Monograph that's available up on our website, or you can actually, if you get into the other items, you can request that. We'll be glad to get you a copy. And then, of course, we hope that you'll go to our website. Notice we have a 4-tape set on Why Do We Still Have Cancer? A 4-tape set on genocide. Get the information, help us to get it out, because believe me, there are people out there with a genocidal agenda, and the life you save could be your own. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and, well, this afternoon or this evening, why, of course, our guest for the next hour is going to be William Grieg, formerly the senior editor for the New American Magazine, a prolific writer. We carry his book, The Liberty in Eclipse. That's Liberty in Eclipse. You can read his articles, and we'll tell you later in the program how to get to his blog site. He actually edits the blog site for the Wealth Society. Tremendous information, and, well, William, thank you very much for being with us again this Friday evening. What are we going to be talking about?
It's always a delight to be with you, and in keeping with what has been our prevailing habit, we have to talk about the economy.
All right, go right ahead.
We are in the midst of a world historic cataclysm. We're seeing really an accelerating meltdown, which was the word used in a very prominent graphic just in the last day or so.
Now, who used that word?
MSNBC.
All right.
Which, of course, is one of the networks on cable television that tracks the economy. And the talking head, the newsreader, as the expression would be used in England, the anchor, who was sitting in front of that graphic, was David Gregory, who's a very highly polished anchor, and he looked very, very nervous. He looked palpably, visibly upset and uneasy. And when you understand the fact that he's married to somebody who's a high-ranking official in Fannie Mae, his disposition, I think, is very crucial, very significant indicator of the fact that we are dealing now with a full-orbed economic catastrophe. And when it gets into the mainstream press, the secular press, that things are really scary. You know things are much scarier than they're letting on. And those of us who've been Cassandras now for a number of years understand that things have been this bad for a long, long time. It's just that we're no longer able to defer reality.
I think it was very so interesting that Cramer, who, of course, is one of the bombastic people, he came out this last week and he said, sell all of your stocks. I mean, do not buy back it again until we get some sort of a stability, till the recession is over. Get out of the stocks, you know, and he's got a lot of people following him. Certainly George Soros is saying the same thing. Robert Rubin, former Secretary of the Treasury, saying the same thing. Of course, you and I have been talking about it for a long time, trying to warn people it was coming and to get out of the stock market. And now, of course, an awful lot of people are going to get out, but they're going to already have lost 50 to 75% of their life savings. And, of course, this is going to impact on pension funds because they're invested in the stock market and the hedge funds. And we're heading to an economic catastrophe. But you go ahead and pick the story.
One really potent indicator of just how bad things are, of course, is that we had another bank run, and it's not getting anywhere near the attention that it should. That, of course, was the IndyMac Bank in Pasadena, California, which has been taken over by the FDIC. You had people lining up to get their money out of this mortgage-generating bank in Pasadena, and they had announced just a couple of days ago that they were going to be laying off, I believe, almost the majority of their employees, at least half of their employees. They just announced that a couple of days ago. And its stock, of course, is negligible now, whereas a couple of years ago it was in high cotton, issuing all kinds of mortgages to anybody who had a visible pulse, and some people for whom the pulse was a dubious proposition. And you take a look at the way the banking system is set up. All fractional reserve banks are, in principle, insolvent. And so it's almost as if you've got this line of mountain climbers who are going up a sheer cliff face of a very high mountain, and they're knotted together by safety lines, and they're all being led up the mountain by this Sherpa, who is the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And what's happening is that below the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the pitons that are holding these mountain climbers to the mountain face, the cliff face, are starting to pop out.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back here. All right. Right, fine. Well, I like that analogy, and we can just see those poor climbers falling Bernanke up the cliff, and of course, they're all going to fall to their death. And the tragedy is, this is really underway today. I mean, the whole financial system in the United States is beginning to implode, and if the average American doesn't believe this could happen, after all, everything's as solid as the dollar, but the dollar is no longer solid or solvent. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, the dollar is something which is completely ephemeral. It's like holding onto a handful of snowflakes. But if you take a look at those mountain climbers, you see one of them falls off the mountain, the one below him is dragged down, and the one below him, and so on and so forth. There are thousands upon thousands of lending institutions and more conventional banks who are all tied up in this huge metastasizing mess that is the meltdown of the entire mortgage industry. It's not just the subprime mortgages, and it's not just residential properties. It's also commercial properties. It's the one engine that was firing in the consumer economy for the last, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, where the generation of mortgages and the creation of spurious equity was being used as a way of funding the larger commercial economy, people taking out loans on the basis of the inflated value of their house so as to consolidate debt, or so as to fund the purchase of consumer items to keep the consumer economy going. And when the logic of this is that when the bubble collapses, it drags everything down with it, and it has to do this. That's simply an inexorable law of economics, as inviolate as the law of gravity, where you have malinvestments and clusters of errors, where you have huge, unsustainable bubbles of credit that are created through a fiat money economy. They have to collapse, and it's going to be painful. It has to be painful. I mean, somebody once said that pain is nature's way of trying to prevent us from acting like boneheads. And there are certain types of pain that we simply have to endure if this economy is ever going to cure itself. But what's happening, of course, is that the same people who created this condition, who abetted this huge and destructive and cataclysmic bubble, are giving us more of the same by way of treating the malady. They're giving us a larger dose of the same affliction in the form of inflation now in order to bail out those really big politically connected interests. And the two that we're looking at right now, this is something I predicted 4 years ago, back when I was associated with the New American magazine. I wrote a piece about the forthcoming nationalization of Fannie and Freddie, the two main government-sponsored entities that were sort of like the twin engines blowing all of this inflationary credit into the mortgage lending economy and the real estate sector. I was predicting in 2004 that we were going to see the nationalization of Fannie and Freddie.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Arthur Stan, and William Greg is pointing out the fact that several years ago he was writing about the impending nationalizations of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the two lending institutions chartered by the government, a quasi-federal organization, supposedly. They're private. They have private stockholders, and both of those stockholders have taken a beating. They've lost 80% of the value of their stock here in the last year. So if you were foolish enough to invest in Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, why, of course, you did real well for a few years, and then you lost it all over this last year. Go right ahead.
Yeah. And the people who were the nomenclatura, the political elite who were running Fannie and Freddie, did very well, and they were very much behaving in the same mold as the Enron geniuses, where they were using this pornographically exotic accounting in order to conceal the amount of insolvency and bad loans they had made and the corruption in their accounting process. And then most of them were able to get out before the complete collapse of Fannie and Freddie, which actually happened in 2003. It flatlined. It was the most amazing thing. If you took a look at their stock profile, if I'm not mistaken, July of 2003, almost exactly 5 years ago, it looked literally like a waterfall. It looked like something from Niagara Falls. It essayed a vertical line down from, I can't remember what the level was, but they shed something like 90% of their value or more just in the course of a couple of days. And that was because there had finally been some kind of tip-off to the larger financial sector that Fannie and Freddie had been practicing what is now called Enronomics. And so you had them shed all this value, and they went into damage control mode, where certain people were allowed to leave on very favorable terms, and others were brought in supposedly to fix what was wrong with Fannie and Freddie, as if you could fix something that is innately flawed to begin with. These so-called public-private partnerships or government-sponsored entities are, by their very nature, unstable and corrupt because they're based on the principle of getting people to subsidize bad investments creates a unique kind of moral hazard. Basically, a public-private entity is the institutionalization of moral hazard here. But Congress held some anodyne hearings, and they started throwing money into Fannie and Freddie so as to pump up the stock price, so as to keep the housing bubble going. And what I was writing back in 2004 was that at the time, the Fannie and Freddie cartel was responsible for something like $4 trillion in mortgage debt. That figure has risen to $5 trillion, and now it's become pretty clear to all and sundry that Fannie and Freddie simply cannot continue. And they're basically the great big backstops for the entire mortgage lending economy. If they go, the whole thing collapses into a black hole. And so what we're going to be told is that they are simply too big to fail, that there is an overriding national interest in maintaining the supposed integrity of these two entities. Fannie, I should point out, was created 50 years ago under the so-called New Deal as a way of pretty much doing what it's been doing since then, which is socializing, incrementally socializing the housing sector. And then Freddie was actually hived off of Fannie in the mid-1960s under Lyndon Johnson, and then created as a separate, or actually given a charter as a separate entity in 1970 under Richard Nixon, supposedly to compete with this other government-sponsored entity. Well, they're not competing with each other, obviously. They're playing for the same team. They're subsidized by the same taxpayers. But you have a situation here where, in the same sense that the Communist Party in 1991 and the Soviet Union decided it would create a whole parade of Communist Party-controlled front parties, these two entities are basically front entities for the same cartel. But what happened over the last week or so is that it's finally become clear that these entities which are behind the entire mortgage lending industry right now in the United States, this cartelized, quasi-socialist mortgage lending industry, are sick unto death. And we're going to be told that there is this high national purpose that has to be served by nationalizing these two mortgage lending institutions and having the government basically take over their debt. That's $5 trillion at least. I'm guessing it's probably multiples of that, of course, if you get into the derivatives, but just to take the round number, albeit a number so large that no human mind can wrap itself around it, $5 trillion, that would add half again the amount of the acknowledged national debt, which is $10 trillion, or a little bit below that. So in one fell swoop, we would add half again the amount of the acknowledged national debt. And in order to do that, what's going to have to happen, because nobody's putting money into the bond market right now. First of all, there's no money to be put into it. We have this liquidity crisis where banks are not lending to each other because none of these banks knows what the other bank is holding in terms of collateral. Their collateral consists of these huge tranches of garbage securities that are securitized bad debts. Nobody wants to use that, of course, as collateral, except that as collateral, rather, for mortgage money, for lending, for bond purchases. So the bond market is not going to be supporting the bailout of Fannie and Freddie or any of these other banks, any of these banks that are going to go under. So what's going to happen is that the Federal Reserve is simply going to have to monetize that $5 trillion debt that the federal government's going to assume here, probably in the next 6 or 8 weeks, I would imagine.
And, of course, really what's even more startling of this review is reported that a number of the major European banks are beginning to pull their money out of the New York banks.
Yeah, that's a big part of the story. You have Barclays Capital and the Royal Bank of Scotland and the Fortis Bank out of Holland, out of the Netherlands. They're all pulling their money out of the United States. And that, of course, is a predictable development, something some of us have been predicting now for a number of years. I'm quite frankly surprised that this exodus from the American financial system didn't begin 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. But it's gotten to the point now where they simply can't defer it any longer. And I think it's remarkable the chairman of Fortis, a fellow by the name of Maurice Lippens, said the following by way of explaining why they're getting out. We have been saved just in time. The situation in the U.S. is much worse than we thought. And then he talks about the fact that there is this meltdown of the not only the mortgage industry, but the entire financial system, where it's expected that there would probably be as many as 6,000 American banks that are at risk for failing this year alone. And we know, and this is something you and I have discussed before, Dr. Stan.
And because really, I think we have about 18,000 banks, and he's talking about a third of the banks.
That's now, whether, the banks. Yeah.
Whether this is realistic or not, I don't know. But incidentally, there is a company that will give you the rating on your bank. It costs you $4, and we actually called it. I think it's Bauer. Anybody wants to know, they can get in touch with us, and I'll give them the telephone number. But actually, you know, my bank is a four out of five. Bank of America was only a 3.5.
Oh, that's amazing.
One of the five largest banks in the United States. But I said to the woman who was telling me what the ranking of my bank was, I said, are there a lot of banks in trouble? And she said, oh, an awful lot of banks are in trouble. Go right ahead.
Well, I mean, once again, they all start out in trouble. The way that they're created as fractional reserve banks means that they begin insolvent. And they're all dependent upon the health of the financial system, which is run by the Federal Reserve. And so when there's a tremor of trouble in that system, then their existence becomes even more imperiled. And so I think that it may be a bit of an exaggeration, a bit of an extravagant estimate that one-third of the banks in the country would fail, but I believe that there are at least one-third of the banks that are in imminent danger of failure. As to whether or not that will happen this year, I don't know.
Well, let's hope and pray that it doesn't, because, of course, the implications would be catastrophic.
Oh, there'd be grass growing in the streets of American cities. And there already is grass growing in the streets of some American cities. I mean, some places we talked about before, like Cleveland and some parts of Atlanta, where huge tracts of housing that had been bought during the boom, now during the bust, are being left vacant and are basically reverting to nature. I mean, entropy is taking place. And so you have these houses starting to rot and fall into states of disrepair that lower the property values of the surrounding communities, and they become the redoubts of drug gangs and people of ill repute of that sort. I mean, that's one of the things that happens when you have a bust following the boom as well, is that you have the reverse gentrification of a lot of places that have been overbuilt during the boom time. And already, literally, you have grass growing in the streets of some of the cities of this country. But if you have a banking crisis of the magnitude that Fortis is anticipating, whether it takes a year or a couple of years, you're talking about the equivalent of an economic dust bowl. And people are not prepared for it, because they're being told basically that things have changed dramatically since the Great Depression, that there are security checks in place that would prevent the type of meltdown we had in the stock market and would prevent the type of wholesale collapse that occurred in 1929 to 1931. And what they're not being told is that things have changed in a direction that's very aversive to our economic health.
I think that people really have no idea that we may be well on the verge of something really catastrophic. Within this last week, gold has gone up $40 an ounce. That's almost a 4% increase in value. Silver has gone up certainly comparably. These are certainly signs. They're bellwether of major cataclysmic events. It's like the canary in the mine shaft. And when the canary drops over dead in the mine shaft, you better start looking for to get out of the mine. Well, right now, of course, when you're beginning to see the price of gold shooting up and silver shooting up, and not a mention in the controlled media. I'm watching the news very carefully. When they start telling you that gold and silver are going up, they've already gotten up as far as they're probably going to go. But right now they're keeping this a secret because they know that at least some Americans have realized that this is the only true source of wealth, that paper money is still paper money. The reason prices are rising is not because the price of certainly of rice and of certainly of soybeans and wheat are going up. It's because of the inflation. We are actually printing so much money. Inflation is not rising prices. Inflation is a result, certainly, of the increase in the money supply, and that brings rising prices. Just as wet streets don't cause rain, if rain causes wet streets, so increasing the monetary supply causes inflation. This is one reason why the price of oil is going up, although not the only one. But certainly we're seeing really skyrocketing prices in the stores, and the government still insists there's no inflation, nothing to worry about. That's why we're not going to raise the interest rates. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg here at the American Freedom Network. Go right ahead, William.
I do want to mention, in connection with the effort to help people understand the rudiments of the crisis that we're confronting right now, and you reflect, you actually recited some of them just before the break, Dr. State. He did so very well, in terms of the fact that it is the increase in money supply, it's the adulteration of the currency that leads to inflation, and that this has immediate and dramatic impacts on society that are destabilizing, that essentially ruin the middle class, that destroy the common bonds economically that hold a free society together in the absence of government coercion. When you have the type of force and fraud involved in the fiat money system that leads to the outright destruction of the value of the currency of a given country, there's a wonderful essay that talks about how this has happened historically and suggests some ways that people can address this crisis to protect themselves about the coming, protect themselves against the coming cataclysm. It's an essay on the conversion of paper to gold. It's written by a fellow by the name of William Denman from Northern Idaho, who's a brilliant man. He's a retired aerospace engineer, if I'm not mistaken. Your listeners should go to ChristianLibertyParty.com. Again, that's one word, ChristianLibertyParty.com, and look at the front page of this website for the Christian Liberty Party. Left-hand side of the page, right at the top of the left-hand column, they can click on a PDF document that talks about the conversion of paper money to gold and silver, and it gives a really good historical overview of how inflation has been inflicted on societies and the results that occur. I believe it starts with not only ancient Rome, but he goes through the French Revolution and goes through some of the modern totalitarian revolutions as well that have all involved this effort to use inflation to destroy the bourgeoisie and the middle class. And then he talks about how people can act if they have the means, and they should acquire the means if they don't, to try to protect their households against the ravages of the hyperinflation that's going to afflict our society. Once again, that's ChristianLibertyParty.com. You go to the front page of this website, left-hand column, top of the page. There's a little PDF file labeled Conversion from Paper to Gold. That's by Bill Denman, a brilliant man, one of the most astute and diligent researchers, not only into the economy, but also into this whole corrupt process of legislation, both at the state and federal level, that has led us to this dire set of circumstances. I really recommend that to your listeners, that everybody get a hold of that paper and read it, because it really is an eye-opener. It's very capably, very engagingly written. But when we talk now about what's unfolding in terms of real-time manifestations of this economic crisis, it's interesting if you take a look at what the airlines are doing right now. They're raising their prices while they're reducing their service. That's very typical of what happens when you're dealing with an inflationary or a potentially hyperinflationary economy. You simply cannot afford, as a producer or the somebody who provides services or the producer of goods, you can't afford to be providing the same level of service or the same quantity of product for the same price that you had offered it before. And so you have to reduce the availability of the service or reduce the amount of the product that you're offering, or you have to raise prices, or you do both. In the airline industry, which is, once again, a public-private partnership, it's effectively a corporatist enterprise rather than being a free market enterprise. It's doing both at the same time. You're getting less service, and you're getting higher prices. And you're having to pay all kinds of premiums and surcharges in order to have anything akin to civilized service.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest, of course, is William Gregg. Gotta go right ahead, William.
Yep. When we talk as well about the idea of offering less quantity of a product in exchange for the same price.
Let me just point out that William is really talking about what happens when you're in an inflationary spiral.
Yes.
We are in an inflationary spiral. And we see this with the airlines, where they're charging more for the tickets, then they're cutting back on services, then they're going to charge us extra for bringing a bag on board. The first American Airlines, the first bag, $10, the second bag, $25, and don't expect any peanuts when you get on the board. Go ahead.
And pretty soon they're going to be fitting us with compliance bracelets. That's something that the Transportation Security Administration, one of the many three-letter agencies that afflict our country, has been talking about. where you have this bracelet that can be used to identify who the flyers are and identify your luggage and monitor you during the whole time you're in an airport and the whole time you're on a flight. And if you evince any type of attitude they don't like, or perhaps give any suggestion of a behavior that they would object to, then you can be shocked into compliance, because it would emit at the command of whatever air marshal would have the control mechanism, an electric charge akin to a taser. You know, this is the sort of thing they're talking about now in terms of literally treating us as if we were livestock aboard these airlines. I heard Neil Livingston, Livingstone, forgive me, a so-called expert on terrorism, one of these people who's a product of the three-letter alphabet soup agency community, on Fox News this morning talk about the fact, as he sees it, that air travel is not a right, it's a privilege, and we should approach it that way. We should understand that this is privilege conferred upon us rather than a way of exercising a right that inheres in us as free individuals. So while this is going on, the poor airlines now are having to cut back on service and cut back on amenities and also start to charge all kinds of surcharges to passengers in order to deal with the fact that they have to keep raising their prices to meet the operating costs in an inflationary environment. Just this afternoon, I was looking at a local paper out of Ontario, Oregon, talking about the fact that there is no longer going to be airline service from Eugene to Phoenix. That was a fairly important little commuter route that had been run by one of the subsidiaries of one of the major airlines in Oregon. Actually, I think it was one of the, it might have been Air West out of Arizona, if I remember correctly, but in any case, they're discontinuing that route, and that's something that's happening now a lot, is that a lot of commuter routes that were being flown are no longer available. The fuel costs are too high. It's no longer economically feasible. And if you take a look at what's going on in the supermarket, in your typical retail store, but specifically, you can take a look at the supermarket, go to the grocery aisle of the supermarket, take a look at the fact that just in the last couple of weeks, General Mills and a lot of the other food producers, with respect specifically to cereals, are putting out smaller boxes of cereal for the same price, I mean dramatically smaller boxes of cereal for the same price. And that illustrates once again that something has to give. Either you have to give less of the product or you have to raise the price for what you're charging for the same quantity of product. And that, of course, reflects not only the fact that shipping costs are very high and the cost of production have increased, but also, of course, the fact that the price of commodities, specifically the grains that go into cereals, all the cereal foods now are going stratospherically high, going parabolic in terms of the price. We've talked about this before, how the prices of wheat and corn and oats have skyrocketed. Part of this reflects the dislocation in the economy inflicted upon it by our good friends in Washington through this bizarre and monumentally corrupt subsidy for ethanol. We are talking about the Archer Daniels Midland gravy train, something like, I believe it was 41 or 43% of everything that Archer Daniels Midland makes by way of profits comes directly from taxpayer subsidies. And there was a report issued just in the last week and a half or so that was leaked to the press. It was a report produced by the World Bank, which is, of course, a dubious institution attached to an even worse institution, the United Nations. But they ran the math, and they believe, and I think this is probably a credible assessment, that about 75% of the increase in food prices globally could be traced back to the ethanol subsidies that have created this bizarre set of incentives that has resulted in a maldistribution of resources into growing corn for the purpose of enriching Archer Daniels Midland. And that's a really good example of how this whole system works. I mean, you have subsidies which are being funneled to this politically connected entity. Our ADM is a huge insider agribusiness combine. It's profited tremendously come feast or famine because they are connected at the hip with Washington, D.C. And in order to keep the subsidies flowing, of course, you have to create these skewed priorities, these politically dictated priorities in the marketplace, rather than letting the marketplace allocate resources. And at the same time, you have to be creating the currency to help keep the subsidies flowing as well.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, of course, is William Grieg. He was just talking about, of course, the subsidies that go to Arthur Daniel Midland for the ethanol production. Now, people have forgotten, really, how this all came about. Senator Robert Dole, a crippled war veteran, leader of the Senate, the Speaker of the Senate, certainly the majority leader in the Senate, got a rather large contributions for his personal foundation from Arthur Daniels Midland. I think a couple of $100,000 donation that they gave to his personal foundation. Wasn't that a nice thing to do? And then, of course, certainly be outdone, why Senator Dole got this legislation that mandated that we would have to add ethanol, and of course at that time it was MTBE, to gasoline to cut down on emissions. Of course, MTBE not only did not cut down on air emissions, it contaminated water supplies all over the state of California and other places where it used, and led to hundreds of millions of dollars of lawsuits and the loss of large water supplies. But of course, this was all because of the altruism of Arthur Daniel Midland's of donating to Robert Dole's personal foundation. Now, I would call that corruption. I would call it bribery, but in Washington, D.C., they don't call it bribery. They call it politics. That's the way the system works. You shouldn't complain and just shut up. And yet, of course, all the suffering that is going to come about because of Robert Dole, who, man, I'm ashamed to say was the speaker of the, or at least the majority leader in the United States Senate, a Republican who betrayed everything. He fought for America, and then he betrayed America for personal advantage. Go ahead.
The other thing I find interesting about Robert Dole is that if you go back to 1996 and look at his presidential campaign, which I think was probably the least plausible Republican presidential bid since FDR suborned Wendell Willkie into running as a Republican in 1940 so that Willkie could throw the election at the behest of the White House and also British intelligence. I mean, that's something that not many people know about, is that Willkie probably never was a Republican. He'd been a registered Democrat until just a few weeks before the election of 1940. In the case of Bob Dole, he ran a fairly unconvincing campaign in 1996. And at the beginning of that campaign, he said something to the effect, as he resigned as the Senate Majority Leader, that he would run this race for the presidency and he had nowhere to go but to the White House or to go home. And most people assumed by home he was referring to Kansas. What he meant was that he'd either win the election and go to the White House, or he would stay at home in Washington, D.C., which had become his natural habitat. He lives at the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C., where he has lived for many, many decades.
And his wife is a United States Senator. We'll be right back here with William Grieg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest this evening, William Grieg, and before we go on, William, will you tell our listeners how they can get your material, how they can get your blog site, how they can get your book?
Okay, I appreciate that. My blog is entitled Pro Libertate, and I try to publish something new on it between 3 and 5 times a week, depending upon what my schedule will permit. And in order to get to Pro Libertate, the easiest way to find it, apart from doing a Google search and using the phrase Pro Libertate, would be to go to the homepage of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. URL for The Right Source is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. And if you go to the front page, the home page of the Welch Foundation, The Right Source, and at the top of the page you will find a banner ad for my new book, Liberty and Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can click through to purchase the book there, or you can order it from Radio Liberty. You can order it through Amazon.com. It's about 300 pages, and it's a detailed overview and expose of the creation of this unitary, militarized homeland security state that is basically premised on the idea that we, the common citizenry, constitute the chief threat to the public order that the homeland security state prefers, which is to say, the protective function of the government is intended to be exercised on behalf of the rulers rather than on behalf of the citizenry. Now, we had in this country until relatively recently, the last 4 or 5 decades, a variegated and locally accountable law enforcement system. It's usually built around the county sheriff, and that's the way it should be. If you go back through Anglo-Saxon antiquity and through the common law and go back through American history until the late 19th century, the county sheriff, and this is still his status today in law, was considered the paramount law enforcement officer, the chief constitutional law enforcement officer in a given county. And state and local police didn't really exist in this country until really the early years of the 20th century. But they were supposed to be locally accountable. That's the scheme that Madison talked about in the Federalist Papers, and he said that the powers given by the Constitution to the central government were to be few and defined. Those reserved to the states were numerous and indefinite. The reserved powers included everything having to do with law enforcement. Well, what's happened is that the federal government, through the use of subsidy and regulation, and through the strategic use of lawsuits and other harassment, has basically broken every police agency in this country to the saddle of federal control. And so you have, rather than a collection, a constellation of locally accountable law enforcement agencies, you really have a unitary system where your local police are affiliates of this centralized Leviathan state. And they're rapidly becoming paramilitary organizations that behave more like a standing army of occupation than as a body of peace officers devoted to protecting rights and property. I talk a lot in my book about how this came about. One of the major contributors is this murderous fraud called the War on Drugs. And the War on Drugs, particularly the asset forfeiture, which is something I'd like to talk about a little bit more in depth in just a minute. Asset forfeiture is simply the seizure of money and property and the prosecution of the seized money and property rather than those who own it. That threatens to become a means whereby police agencies will become completely independent of local control because they have a revenue stream that they control, that they do not have to solicit from municipal governments. Combine that with federal subsidies to the Department of Homeland Security, through the Pentagon, through the Justice Department, you basically have a system now where these local, supposedly local, geographically in any case, local police agencies are appendages of Washington. That's a big part of the story I tell in Liberty and Eclipse. I also talk about the emergence of the so-called unitary executive, which is nothing more or less than presidential dictatorship through executive decree. I talk about the institutionalization of torture, which has gotten a little bit of attention in recent weeks, but once again, nowhere near as much attention as it should have gotten. And I talk about the emergence of an ethic that's really troubling, where our law enforcement agencies are filled with people, usually the younger people who are being brought in now, the cadres that are filling, if you will, law enforcement today, have adopted a military mindset with respect to the public. They think in terms of compelling people to submit rather than coming to the aid of individuals who are endowed by God with inalienable rights that the government has to respect. That's a really important Rubicon that's been crossed in terms of the psychology of law enforcement, where they think of themselves in military terms rather than as peace officers. How often do you hear law enforcement officers talk about themselves in contrast to the civilian population? That's not just a slip of the tongue, and this is not an instance of the sort that Isaiah warned against when he said you shouldn't make people a sinner for a word. If you're talking about the civilian population as opposed to the law enforcement population, the law enforcement population has to be some sort of a military body. It was understood until very recently that the law enforcement was supposed to be a civilian function, that police officers may wear uniforms and they may wear insignia of rank, but that they were civilians. They were not, in any sense, military. But that's something which has really been eclipsed, and to use the word once again that I chose for the title, by this new ethic of homeland security. And it's something that's been decades in the making, but it's really reached fruition in the last 4 or 5 years, largely accounting to 9/11, of course, which was purely opportunistic. It's not because of 9/11 that this has happened. 9/11 offered a pretext to accelerate the process that was already well underway. But you can get that through the Welch Foundation website or through Radio Liberty or through Amazon.com. And if you go to RightSourceOnline.com, scroll down about a third of the way down the page, look at the left-hand side of the page, you'll find my photograph. And next to my photograph, there's a hyperlink to the Pro Libertate blog. Once again, that comes out in terms of a new essay between 3 and 5 times a week. It's often republished by Lou Rockwell at his invaluable website, lourockwell.com. As a matter of fact, the last couple of days he's republished some of my essays. And my purpose in writing Pro Libertate is not to maintain a blog in the conventional sense, which is like an open diary. Probabilitate is my chief means of pursuing my passion, which is investigative journalism of a polemical variety. I call myself an investigative polemicist. I write editorial pieces. I don't disguise my point of view, but I try to back my point of view up with as much hard, documentable information as I can find. And one of the really beautiful luxuries of the Internet as a means of communicating journalistically is that you can use hyperlinks to take people back to a lot of the material to document and verify, corroborate what you're saying. And so the purpose of Pro Libertate is to try to infuriate people about the myriad and metastasizing abuses of individual liberty that characterize the system that rules us right now. So really there's no shortage here of outrage, or that is to say, of sources of outrage. There is a shortage of useful outrage. People are scared right now about the economy. They're worried about a lot of things, but there's relatively little principled outrage. And I'm doing my level best to sow discontent in the hopes of harvesting the type of outrage that eventually would be used to build some kind of a movement to recover some semblance of what has been taken from us over these many decades. And once again, I try to publish something new between 3 and 5 times a week. I work out of my home here, and I'm primarily responsible for the upbringing of the lovely kids that God has given my wife Corinne and myself. We have 5 lovely children. Our oldest is 10, so sometimes there are demands on my time that won't permit me to get to my keyboard and write, but to the extent that I have the time, that's what I'm trying to do, is to use that medium to promote the message of outrage over the assaults on our freedom and a determination on my part to help people understand that freedom is something certainly worth fighting for.
Amen to that. Well, go right ahead.
I wanted to talk a little bit about this subject of asset forfeiture, because as you'd mentioned way back in, I think, the first segment of the program tonight, Dr. Stan, when we see the collapse of the investment economy, and you see how people are not willing to lend money to invest, and the bond market is becoming really, really sickly, that has a lot of impact on what's going to happen to, among other things, municipal pensions. And one of the last things that we can anticipate would be that any government anywhere is going to cut back on the benefits that it gives its employees. Note how I refer to them as employees and not workers. You know, we're dealing with people who are involved in purely consumption-oriented human exercise. This is not a human enterprise that adds one whit to the value of our society. These are people who are purely oriented toward consumption, the tax-eating class. What I mentioned before with respect to asset forfeiture is that through this enterprise in folly that we call the war on drugs, and pursuant, ironically enough, to a United Nations treaty that the government entered into in the 1970s, it's now possible for police agencies, not just federal agencies, but also state police and county sheriffs and local police departments, to seize money and to seize other assets that are supposedly involved in some kind of illegal behavior. Usually it has some nexus to narcotics, but that by no means exhausts the possibilities. In some places, for instance, Naperville, Illinois, there's a very long list of things that you can do that the police can use to justify seizing your car, confiscating it, and forfeiting your car. If you have a certain number of traffic tickets, if you are found to be listening to your stereo too loud in the given area of the community, if you're convicted of a number of crimes that have nothing to do with the operation of a automobile, you can still have your car impounded and then forfeit it to the city, and the city can then sell your automobile and use the proceeds as it sees fit. That's just one example in Naperville, Illinois. There are a number of places, for instance, in Missouri and in Kansas, where people can have their cars confiscated if they're found to be playing their stereos too loudly. That's one very common and increasingly common form of asset forfeiture. Another form of asset forfeiture that's very common is highway robbery, where motorists are stopped for various traffic infractions, and as a result of the stop, the law enforcement officer making the stop will ask for consent to search your automobile. Never, 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 never give your consent to a search of your automobile. Cooperate with the policeman. You know, be nice to him. After all, he has a gun and he has a government-issued license to kill you if he sees fit to do so. So be nice to that gentleman, but don't do anything by way of volunteering. Don't be cooperative in any sense. It may not change what happens on the ground at the traffic stop, but it may give you the legal ground to go back and revisit the incident should you end up having your property confiscated. There are a number of places, particularly in Texas, which has a number of north-south corridors, both state and U.S. highways that run down to Mexico, where various state police and local police and sheriff's departments basically have confiscation squads. They have forfeiture squads that conduct pretext stops so that they can search the vehicles in the hope of finding what they call contraband, which is a large sums of cash. At least some of that cash, of course, is involved in the narcotics economy. It stands to reason that is a huge market in this country, the biggest in the world. We have the most expensive drug interdiction effort, and we have the highest rates of addiction here in this country, and that's because these things are symbiotic. It's an evil and corrupt symbiosis between the underworld of narcotics dealers and the political overclass, which is a program in place basically to keep the price of narcotics up. That's all prohibition is, basically, is a price support program for drug lords. So in Texas, you have all these major north-south highways, such as I-35, for instance, that run through these towns in isolated places where they have speed traps. And so when somebody is stopped for a traffic violation, for speeding or for failing to make a signal when he's changing lanes, anything of the sort, there's always this effort to make a search of the vehicle so as to look for contraband meaning large sums of cash. And under existing federal court decisions, one of which was handed down just a couple of years ago, it's considered to be probable cause for the purpose of asset forfeiture. If you have a large sum of money and you're operating a motor vehicle, that's considered to be probable cause for suspicion that you're involved in narcotics trafficking, either as a drug courier or as a money courier. And so it's become very common for a number of law enforcement agencies along these highways in Texas basically to fund themselves through the use of asset forfeiture. Now, it's not just in Texas either. One of the case studies that I've written about a couple of times, is in Dallas County, Iowa. You wouldn't think with a name like Dallas County, you're talking about Texas, but no, you're talking about Iowa. Dallas County, Iowa sits astride Interstate 85, which, of course, is a major east-west highway, freeway, actually, running through the heartland. Anybody who's done a lot of travel through the Midwest from either coast has probably taken the I-85 at some point or another. My family and I have done that a number of times. Well, Brian Gilbert, the former sheriff of Dallas County, in his county sheriff's department, over the last 10 years or so, have managed to forfeit literally millions upon millions of dollars, both in cash and vehicles. They have standardized forms that would be used when somebody would be in a traffic stop and suspected and be accused of having some kind of a connection to narcotics smuggling. They have standardized forms where you can simply turn your vehicle over to them in exchange for not having charges pressed against you. And they would take the vehicles and sell them at auction or otherwise make use of them for county business. And anytime there was money found in a vehicle of this sort, the money was confiscated and forfeited to the county. And using this means of what I consider to be unambiguous highway robbery, Dallas County Sheriff's Department had collected tens of millions of dollars over the first 5 or 6 years of this decade. Well, what happened is that Sheriff Brian Gilbert got a little bit too greedy. There was one traffic stop that involved the confiscation of several burlap sacks of money in $100 bills and other large denomination notes in the amount of about $120,000 in aggregate funds. And Sheriff Gilbert just helped himself with the money. He just took it out of the evidence locker, and he was caught taking it home with him. And so, of course, he was prosecuted for theft. I mean, if he had simply allowed the money to be forfeited to the sheriff's department or to the county, there would have been no problem. But he got a little bit too greedy. He got sticky fingers as he tried to take it home for his own use, and so he was prosecuted for felony theft, and that's a huge felony theft. That's grand theft. And he ended up getting a 10-year suspended sentence. And if I remember correctly, he got just a couple of years supervised probation and a very brief period of community service. This is for stealing $120,000 that was, quote-unquote, government property, now that it had been forfeited to the county. But that's a pretty good example of the type of unbooted corruption that we're seeing fester in law enforcement agencies. And one of the reasons that this is happening once again is because it's looked upon as free money. If you get the money through asset forfeiture, you're fighting a good fight. You're fighting the war on drugs, supposedly. There's a former police chief who's with a group called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He's the former chief of police for Seattle. His name is Norm Stamper. And what he has to say about this process is really quite revealing.
Well, that's all. We'll be back in just a moment here. Go right ahead, William.
Okay, I've been mentioning former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper. He's with a group called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. These are all veteran police chiefs and sheriffs and detectives who are good, conscientious law enforcement officers who have come to the conclusion that the war on drugs is a cynical, corrupt exercise that promotes an evil symbiosis between law enforcement and the political culture in this country and the narcotics underworld. This is what he has to say. Law enforcement at all levels of government has become dependent on the drug war, which in turn is predicated on drug prohibition. They are addicted to the revenue streams that have become predictable and necessary for the day-to-day operations of departments all across the country. State and local governments get anti-crime funding from the federal government, and there are line items dedicated to things like those regional narcotics task forces. Parenthetically, he's talking about the Byrne Grant program, which was going to be zeroed out of the federal budget. And this last year, police agencies across the country have been openly lobbying for the restoration of Byrne Grant funds, which create these regional task forces to go out and confiscate assets as a way of funding law enforcement. To continue, from Chief Stamper, it wasn't a whole lot of money at first, but over the years, we are now talking billions of dollars. Both police departments and individual officers have a strong vested interest in maintaining prohibition. What he doesn't talk about, by the way, once again, if I might interject, is the fact that the drug lords have a strong interest in maintaining prohibition, too. Prohibition of alcohol made the underworld, the conventional mafia underworld, it made this crime family that we call the Kennedys. You know, there was this, what used to be called the Bootlegger Baptist Alliance. Baptist, in this instance, being sort of a symbolic term to talk about people who favored prohibitionist policies. There was always this corrupt entente between the bootleggers and the prohibitionists because it was to their mutual benefit. The prohibitionists, of course, had a political issue they could exploit, and then they had also a source of revenue they could exploit because the governments were paying very lucrative sums of money to the agencies to enforce prohibition, and at the same time, it created a huge, I use the word inflated, not that we're talking about monetary inflation, we're talking about a type of artificial scarcity that inflated the price of the contraband product.
Well, William, I hate to tell you this, we're out of time.
Oh,
I agree with what you're saying. There's so many people who honestly think, well, we've got to do something. Drugs are terrible. They destroy people's lives. And they do. However, certainly we're not going about it the right way. We have over 2.3 million people in prison today. We're out of time. Good night. God bless.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Dr. Stan here, and of course we could go on probably for two or three more hours with William Greek. We always enjoy having him on, and of course William feels that the current drug laws are actually helping the drug lords, and of course I believe they're also helping the CIA, which is the largest drug dealer in the United States and probably in the world. I mean, right now, the United States controls Afghanistan. It is producing 90% of the opium. And, of course, we're not doing anything to stop the opium trade there, which, of course, we're told is helping the Taliban. So by not trying to block the drug trade, we're helping the Taliban. Why are we doing that? Why? Because, of course, the war on drugs is as phony as a $3 bill. If you'd like to get our information on it, we have a 4-tape set entitled Is there really a war on drugs? It's six different segments are there, and if you listen to those, you'll be as convinced as I am. The war on drugs is totally fallacious. You'll want to get the book Kiss the Boys Goodbye, which we have at the second-hand books, but it's the story of the men we abandoned in Vietnam and the CIA involvement in the drug trade. The book has been actively suppressed for many years, but we do have some used copies are available. Kiss the Boys Goodbye. So, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you'll want to get that. And, good. Of course, we hope that many of you will want to get the other material available from Radio Liberty. We certainly carry Liberty and Eclipse by William Grieg. If you'd like some of our interviews with William, of course, we could put together a four-tape set for you. If you want to understand what's happening financially, you need to hear my talk on the financial tsunami. And, of course, it comes with a syllabus. You'll want to get a four-tape set on the financial Armageddon. That's the financial Armageddon. You'll want to get my pamphlets on the history of money and then the pamphlet on the financial meltdown. The history of money and the financial meltdown, that will give you a good insight into what's going on, and at least my view, which would be very controversial, as to why Alan Greenspan intentionally created the problems we face today. And if you haven't read his book, Age of Turbulence, incidentally, it's well worthwhile reading. It will give you tremendous insight into this man who actually brought about this terrible tragedy that we face today. We have the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, the classic book on finance here, that really understand the background of fiat money. We have Professor Sutton's book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. That's The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. A little pamphlet entitled, or I shouldn't say a little pamphlet, it's actually in book form, but it's called Fiat Money Inflation in France, which goes into the background of the inflationary spiral that came about in France after the French Revolution in 1789. So if you get my talk on the financial tsunami with the syllabus, if you get the pamphlets on the history of money, on the financial meltdown, if you get the books, The Creature from Jekyll Island, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and Fiat Money in France, you'll know more than most political scientists, most economists today. And then, of course, we do hope you'll want to get my material on the financial, I should say, on the spiritual forces that are working within the financial system. We actually have a little pamphlet. It was actually dictated by a demonic spirit known as Joao Cool to Alice Bailey. It's circulated today by the Lucis Trust, which used to be the Lucifer Trust. It's entitled The Workings of the Spiritual Hierarchy. And if you order anything else, and you order that, well, we'll be glad to give that to you free of charge. You need to get my talk on the forbidden secret with the syllabus. You need to get the talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that. You need to get the talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness and the book that goes with that. You must understand there are powerful spiritual forces at work behind what's going on today. And, of course, the little pamphlet, The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy, will tell you that they have their people planted in financial institutions in both the East and the West. They're talking about it first behind the Iron Curtain or in Russia and right here in the United States. And understand that nothing going on today really makes sense unless you understand that there are powerful spiritual forces directing the course of human affairs. Then please, of course, remember our number is 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty.
Tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour radio show. Dave Von Kleist will not be joining us. This is Joyce. Josh will be here at the board, and we thank you very much for joining us in the Power Hour today. It is Friday, and it is July 11th. We have a big day ahead of us of news on this program. And in the second hour, an interesting gentleman who's been here with us one time before represents